On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's a battle royal raging over the future of the World Wide Web and the Internet right now, and it's all about money and the egalitarian spirit of the web. From the beginning and by design, the web has been a come-one-come-all public square, where little bloggers and pipsqueak websites could go nose-to-nose with the big guys. Now, the big corporations who bring the Internet to your home and office want to charge big bucks for priority seating in the online world. That would favor the kind of corporate giants that already dominate radio, TV, and cable, and maybe squeeze out the little guy. Critics are screaming bloody murder and demanding net neutrality. Up next on Point, money, democracy, and the battle for the heart of the web. Joining me first today from New York is Adam Cohen. He's a member of the New York Times editorial board, author of The Perfect Store, Inside eBay. He's written about the battle for and against net neutrality. Adam Cohen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
We know this has the cognoscenti up in arms, but it can sound a little esoteric. What exactly is going on here? What are people fighting about?
Well, they're fighting over, in some ways, the future of the Internet. There are those who believe that the golden age of the Internet as we know it, in which everyone is able to access it on an equal basis, anyone can set up a website and anyone else in the world can view it, that golden age may be about to end. And there have been a few signs of that, but probably the shot fired at Fort Sumter, if you will, of this battle was last year, the CEO of what is now AT&T said publicly that he was tired of people thinking that they were going to use his pipes for free. And the implication was that AT&T and other big internet service providers might start creating a dual system, a dual track where there's a high speed route for people who pay a lot of money to connect to you and a low speed route for everyone else. And people do worry that this will mean that the little guys are going to get shut out and that innovation will get shut out.
So these are telephone companies, cable companies who deliver the net to your house with the web writing on it. And that's what they're talking about here. They're saying what? Everybody's been playing more or less on an equal playing field. We want to create a hierarchy where big corporations can pay a lot of money so they can deliver their video and their music and whatever else they've got at a higher speed to you than all the little guys. No more open field, flat public square here, but a hierarchy?
That's correct. And that really would change the way things have operated on the Internet and on the web since it began. As you mentioned, I wrote a book about eBay and its early origins. And that company was started by one little programmer in his second bedroom at home setting up a website. And the time came when he was competing against Amazon and Yahoo. And if he had had to pay a lot of money in order to get to people's homes, eBay might very well never have been created. You'd only get, new sites being created by the Yahoos, the Amazons, and the Microsofts of the world.
So critics say this would make the web, which has been famously democratic, more like, let's say, cable TV, where you've got big media playing. But as you say, Ed Whitaker, who was chairman of SBC Communications, then they bought AT&T for $16 billion not that long ago. And he's soon after saying, now what they would like to do, and this is everybody from Google and Microsoft and eBay to the little guys, now what they would like to do is use my pipes free. That is the wire or that brings this into homes and offices. But Ed Whitaker says, but I ain't going to let them do that because we have spent this capital, that $16 billion, and we have to have a return on it. Is that unfair, Adam Cohen? After all, they are delivering this. We're accustomed to paying for things that get delivered.
Yeah, but the thing is, people are paying for the things that are being delivered. You and I and others are paying for our internet service connection every month, so we are paying for it. And, that statement really rankled people on the other side in so many ways. But one of the ways was he said that they're his pipes. But in fact, in many ways, those cable and telephone pipes belong to all of us because they were laid with the permission of local governments. You and I couldn't just start tearing up the streets of New York or Boston and lay down lines. So in some ways, there's some more complicated ownership going on here. And because of that, it's appropriate that it be a regulated area, and Ed doesn't seem to see it that way.
So make this more concrete for us. If this should go through, this kind of new hierarchy of the web where, as people are saying, toll booths get set up on the Internet superhighway, and they'd be pretty high tolls, what is likely to get advantaged, and what's likely to be squeezed out or squeezed to the margins?
Well, anything with a large company behind it is likely to be very accessible. But what we're seeing now on the Internet, and it's been really, you know, wonderful to watch, is a proliferation of sort of independent video sites. There's a site called YouTube where you can go, and the minute something interesting happens on TV, or even if someone is just using a handheld telephone or camera to record it, it goes up there. And you can really watch all these things, you know, hundreds of thousands of videos from your computer.
And this is every man and every woman putting up whatever they see in the world.
Absolutely. Or it could be the Steve Colbert video from when he spoke at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. You could see that also on Google Video. So that kind of independent grassroots video, and as I say, I think the Internet is moving much more towards video, will be shut out, and you're more likely to just see whatever Time Warner wants you to see, whatever Microsoft wants you to see.
And you'll see that because they will have bought more lanes on the information superhighway. They can shoot that down faster and more effectively. The hierarchy that is envisioned here than the little guys can.
Right. And YouTube and these other sites that allow independent people to put up their own videos, they're not going to be able to compete with Yahoo and Google and Microsoft in terms of paying the Internet service providers. So when I talked to Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the web, he actually said that what we're going to lose is the idea of what we know as the Internet. What we're going to get is something like cable TV, where large companies that pay to deliver you video will be able to give you video, but that may not be the video that you would like to see.
And that vision of the web as a technology that kind of sparks a global democracy dented by that, but there is another perspective on this entirely. We're going to hear it in a moment. Let me ask you first, Adam. There are moves in Washington to enforce net neutrality. That is, you can't buy privilege through legislation. What do those look like? That sounds pretty complicated.
Well, you know, communications are a very regulated area anyway, so it wouldn't be that unusual. It would just be saying there's a principle of net neutrality that ISPs, Internet service providers, have to respect it. And ideally, it would give power to the FCC to create some regulations to enforce that. And, you know, if you think about it, when you use your telephone right now, you can be confident that if your mother calls, it's going to be given the same priority as if Time Warner Cable calls. And that would be the same principle. The government is actually pretty good at enforcing neutrality, and it wouldn't be that hard to do.
Adam Cohen, stand by. I want to welcome another voice in here from Washington. Scott Cleland is with us. He's chairman of netcompetition.org. He's a spokesman for a coalition of broadband, telecom, cable, and wireless companies who want to let market forces go to work on the web. Scott Cleland, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, and for the opportunity to be here.
So give us your perspective on this. We know that the net neutrality battle cry is the opposite of what you're working for here. Why do you want companies to be able to buy kind of advantaged delivery on the web? What would the advantage be of that for consumers as a whole?
Well, first, Tom, if I could, I need to address some of what I think, with all due respect to Adam, some false statements that are being made. And first of all, you know, saying horrors, there's a dual-track Internet that might happen. It's always been that way. I mean, every one of your listeners knows that there's dial-up, which is the slow lane, and there's about 30-odd million of them, and there are now 37 million people that have chose to pay more, and in some instances pay less, to get a fast lane. That's what competition is. That's how the Internet has evolved over time.
Okay, but that's driven from the consumer side. I want it faster. I pay more to get it faster. Now we're talking about making it on the delivery side. A hierarchy
The thing is on the backbone, it's always been tiered as well, it's been tiered based on speed and on size. And so people saying, oh, net neutrality is the way it's always been, it just isn't true. There is tiering on the backbone. There's tiering. People know dial-up. They know broadband. They know they can pay for different speeds of broadband or DSL.
Yeah, we get that, but we don't want to get lost in that, because you know that is true, that there are gradations here, but yet the general ethos has been a relatively flat one, and we're talking about a structural change, and that you're not apologizing for. You're saying, let the market forces work. Why?
Well, because that's what's led to new innovation and it's led to new services. Let's remember that cable modems, over 20 million Americans get their internet from that. They've never had net neutrality. The people that have 200 million cell phones, there's now more cell phones than there are phones. That's never had net neutrality. So people want to say, you know, net neutrality, just keep it the way it is. It's just not true. It's a vestige of a regulated era for dial-up that has gone away as the market has gotten more competitive.
Do you think the egalitarian era on the web is over, should be over, that it's time for companies who have the money and the product to deliver it to have prominence, whether it's x-rays for doctors to read or music or video? Is that the right way for the web to go, Scott Cleland?
Yes, it is, because everybody that's listening knows that's the way it's developed since 1995.
You keep insisting on that, but you know, the people protesting this are not exactly ignorant about the internet. Tim Berners-Lee doesn't like it, and he invented it.
Well, and with all due respect to him, he was a genius, and he did invent it. And this net neutrality has no effect on the World Wide Web. It has no effect on IP being the universal language. It has no effect on the addressing scheme, that ICON. People talk about these principles. Where is this principle? Nobody can point to it. It is buried into vestige regulatory regulation that went away as the market became more competitive.
Adam Cohen, Scott Cleland says, hey, the whole idea of net neutrality is a dream. The egalitarian internet, it's passed by anyway.
Well, I won't accuse him of making false statements, but I will say that people already know the difference between using their internet and using their cable TV. Using their cable TV, they have a limited number of channels, which often people complain they can't find anything on. When you use the internet, literally the entire world is open to you, and we're going to see the internet become more like cable TV. I think people will feel that as a real difference.
Joining us right now from San Diego is Lawrence Lessig, professor at Stanford Law School, founder of the school's Center for Internet and Society, author of Free Culture, The Nature and Culture of Creativity. Lawrence Lessig, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How do you see this debate? What's really at stake here?
Well, I think what's at stake is exactly what Adam described. What's at stake is whether the future of the internet affords the widest range of competition for applications and content. And I think it's exactly the issue as you framed it, whether freedom to be on the internet is preserved equally for providers and not whether people are paying different amount of money to get different speeds to the internet. I think Scott's mischaracterized the character of this debate to the extent he says that anybody really is questioning whether somebody's allowed to buy faster service or pay more to get a certain kind of quality. What's at stake here is whether cable and telecom companies have the right to engage in whatever kind of discrimination they want. So the real question is, should they be allowed, for example, to pick and choose what applications run on the network, what content you can get to the network, what devices you can attach to the network, and finally, should they be able to say, because you've got popular content, you're going to be charged much more, or because you've got popular content, we're going to put you on a slow lane unless you pay us for access to the fast lane. That's the critical issue here.
Lawrence Lessig, you look at this in very large terms. What does it finally matter at bottom, at heart, to society, to the world, if the internet has this hierarchy develop around market forces, or if it stays, as you would describe it, more open, more egalitarian?
Well, I would first reject the idea that this is about market forces versus something else. This is about two different kinds of markets. So is it a market where there'll be lots of competition in applications and services, or is it a market where a few companies, the network owners, control the nature of competition in the future? Now, my view is the market that the internet created, which embraced this principle of network neutrality from its birth, was called by network theorists the end-to-end principle, but that's exactly the same principle. That network gave us the most explosive and powerful economic growth that we've seen in the last 50 years, exactly because it was neutral. Now, it's not about trading off markets versus some other set of values, even though I agree with Adam that what's also at stake here is the extraordinary opportunity of the widest range of people to bring their ideas to the network and have them dealt with, have them treated in this relatively equal way. Not that everybody gets prime time viewing, but there's not blockage built into the system that basically sets up a slow lane while at the same time allowing premium cable-like content to be streamed into some fast service.
Scott Cleland, is that inevitable? If we go down this path, does it mean premium lanes and slow lanes, big media and other companies with faster, more prominent delivery on the web, and little guys at the margins are out entirely? Is that how you envision the future?
that's the way that the internet is evolving. If people want to use the internet on their cell phone, they realize they're going to get a slower speed. However, they're going to pay for the convenience of mobility. People, if they want to have faster service, and Comcast came out today with something called Power Boost to turbocharge and give you more speed if you're going to download. So the marketplace has all sorts of ways to respond to consumers' needs for wanting differential service if they're willing to pay
for it.
But
you keep looking at the consumer reception end of this, and as I understand it, this is all about the sort of producer delivery end of it, the carrier end of it.
Absolutely. Nobody in this debate who's pushing the idea, nobody serious in debate who's pushing the idea that consumers can't opt into better service. So every time you repeat that argument, you're talking about a different debate. The debate in this case is whether providers have to be charged twice to be able to provide content on the network. Because contrary to the statement of Mr. Whitaker, Google and Yahoo and everybody else pays to be on the internet. Not only do I pay when I get access, they pay for the bits that they send across the network. The question here is whether they can be charged twice, whether you say to them, not only are you going to pay for ordinary service, but we're going to charge you a premium, and if you don't pay it, we're going to push you into a slow lane. That's what this debate is about. It's not whether you're allowed to use cell phones to get access to the internet.
Scott?
Well, anybody that has a cell phone knows that they can pay additional for some data services, so they already do it. But let me say, this debate is really a philosophy system debate. It's whether we're going to have a socialized internet democracy or whether we're going to have a free market democracy. That's really what this is about, is whether or not net neutrality basically wants the government to go in and enforce that all bits are treated equally. And in order to do that, you would have to have heavy government control. You'd have to have monitoring and surveillance. And they say, oh, we don't want that. But the thing is this is one monster slippery slope. And nobody has said, how do you get the good things and not have bad things happen? Nobody's addressed that issue.
Now we're getting down to it here. Adam Cohen, it does end up at bottom, as I read it, in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere, being described as a philosophical debate. In a way, both sides describe it that way. Scott Cleland would almost say this is socialism versus capitalism, Adam.
Yeah, you could say that, but you could also say it's democracy versus anti-democracy, and that's one element we haven't really touched on yet. But there's a real concern that the telecoms and the cable companies would use their power to discriminate against views that they don't support. And it's interesting that this debate about net neutrality has really not broken down along ideological lines. The Christian Coalition, the Gun Owners of America, other conservative groups also very much support net neutrality. And the Christian Coalition said, you know, what if some cable company whose board of directors really favors abortion decides they don't want to let communications go through on their lines that are, as they say, pro-life? Well, what is really at stake here is whether the government will enforce a neutral democratic platform in which all views are expressed, or do we want to give the telecoms and the cable companies the right to pick and choose which communication they like more than others?
I want to begin to bring our listeners in here. I've got a call first, if you would, Scott, from Atlanta, Georgia. Tom's calling. Hi, Tom, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Good. What do you think, Tom? What do you hear?
All right. Here's the thing. A quick little joke. I don't think Al Gore had this planned when he invented the internet. But at the same time, when I go on my email, I don't want to be charged one day for just accessing my Gmail account. Or if my daughter goes online, I don't want to hear that I have to pay $10 so she can go on some MySpace.
Well, what about if it's not you, but rather a corporation paying to bring you music or video or X-rays faster online than they can now? Do you have a problem with that?
I see, it's not the problem. It's just when they start to do the filtering, and then when they start to tell people exactly what they feel that they should want to watch, or what they feel that I should see, because I don't like anybody telling me to do anything. And I'm one of the people who you're going to have to convince before they feel like they want to be told what they can do. If I want to go on a certain website about a certain gun or a certain issue or a certain church, I should be able to do that. See, that's what it's going to be a problem when these filters start to come in, just so you can do something faster, because I think people are really happy with the plan that we have right now for the most part.
Tom, I've got it. The View from Atlanta, I think this is more about the supply side, if you will. And, of course, some of the backers of this change would say you'll get better services here. Scott Cleland, I don't want you to feel ganged up on here today. We invited AT&T. We couldn't get them on, but we did talk with Mark Cuban, the billionaire owner of the Dallas Mavericks, internet entrepreneur, couple of months back, he came out on this show against net neutrality and for this new hierarchy. Let's listen to that.
Basically, there's a tendency in the internet to have an open source attitude, if you will, where anything that a big company, particularly a telco or network provider, might do to change the way things are is perceived as negative. And I looked at the situation and I didn't see it the same way. I thought that there are a lot of applications right now that would be very valuable to the general population, like medical applications, that are being priced out of their reach. If the network operators, like the telcos, like the cable networks, created tiers, then the open source community could write applications that worked with that tiered service of provision, if you want to call it that.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it opened the internet up more, and because you can take applications that traditionally have to be bandwidth hogs in order to try to work well, you actually could improve the performance for everybody else.
That's Mark Cuban talking with us in February. Dallas Mavericks owner, internet entrepreneur, saying you can have an internet that works better if you do it this way. Let me take a call from Washington, D.C. We've got Steve Efros calling. I think this is the Steve Efros who used to work for the FCC. Mr. Efros, are you there?
I am here.
What do you hear? What do you know, sir?
Well, I'm a little concerned about the confusion in the debate. There are a lot of people who are concerned, rightly, that they don't want anybody telling them where they can go or what they can do on the web. And all of the carriers, the cable companies, the telephone companies, have already said, look, number one, we've never done that. Number two, we have no intention of doing that, and that's not what we're talking about. If there were a piece of legislation tomorrow that said, okay, no one can intentionally degrade or block legal websites, virtually everybody would say, hey, that's fine, we'll go for it.
And you mean degrade in reference to others?
Right.
Rather than advantage? Advantage?
Let's go one step at a time.
Okay.
They would all agree with that. The issue is not blocking somebody from getting to a website. The issue is there are companies now that want to use the web in ways that it can't be used right now. It isn't good enough.
Such as?
Such as delivering high-definition television in a streaming fashion.
Right. Okay.
The web is going to have to – we're going to have to spend a whole lot more money before the web can do that. That's an enhanced service. Now, think of the U.S. mail. The regular mail service is one thing, and then the mail offers express mail, and then it offers next day.
Mm-hmm.
If Amazon wants to start delivering frozen food, they need to use next day, not regular. Okay? Anybody can still go to Amazon. They can still get what they want. They can still talk with whoever they want. But if Amazon wants to start delivering frozen food, why should everybody on the internet have to pay more prices to rebuild the entire internet so that Amazon can deliver frozen food?
We've got the perspective, and we appreciate it. Steve Efros, once with the FCC, Lawrence Lessig, how about it? This isn't about degradation for anybody. This is about enhancement where we need it.
Yeah, I don't think that's the issue. First of all, in fact, it is the question that's before this debate right now, whether telecom companies or cable companies have the right to block certain applications, for example, voice over IP. And that was one of the principles that was very central to what the FCC's regulation was under Michael Powell, that they couldn't block in that way.
This is internet telephony, telephone service on the web. And there was, I think, somewhere an effort to actually block a particular...
Right. Madison River was a company that was alleged to have blocked voice over IP, and then the FCC jumped in right away and stopped it. Under principles which Michael Powell outlined for freedoms of the internet, which are at the core of every claim for network neutrality. But the more fundamental point that Scott, I think, is just misstating is the question is not whether people can pay to get better access. In the network neutrality debates that we've been talking about, the question is kinds of access. So, for example, let's say that a cable company says, if you want to get high-quality video service across our network, here's the price you've got to pay. That's fine because they're not saying we're going to offer it just to AT&T, just to Yahoo and not to Google, or we're going to block Google or we're not going to offer it because we're doing an exclusive with one of the providers.
So you don't mind if there's a price tag put on the delivery speed and quality? That's fine with you?
Yeah, the narrow business practice that is being attacked here is setting preferences on the basis of particular relationships with particular companies, as opposed to broad-scale categories where you say, here's the price that you get for high-quality video service on our network. That's the one limit that is being insisted upon in this debate, and that limit is just to avoid the kind of perverse effect or perverse incentive to continue to provide bad service in the broadband context for everybody while you're providing premium service in one area for just the partners. And the reason this is so important is, you know, people talk about how much it's going to cost to build broadband. We've got to remember, under these principles of basically let them do what they want, we have built one of the worst broadband networks in the world. We're like 13th or 16th, depending on which scale you look at. And that's a failure in us delivering these products, and it's not a failure that comes from the regulation of the FCC.
Adam Cohen, I know I've got to let you go in a second here. How do you see this evolving? There have been half a dozen bills proposed in Congress, some that would be quite strict in enforcing net neutrality, nobody advantaged. Do you think those are going to pass? What does support look like there?
Well, it's an uphill struggle because the net neutrality people need to get legislation passed. And if they don't, then the other side wins. They haven't been doing so well until recently. There was one vote in a committee that kind of went their way. But the telecoms and the cable companies are spending a lot of money. So I'm not sure that there will be legislation. But on the other hand, when I talked to Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the web, he said that this was mainly an American problem. And he said, look, Europe and the rest of the world are way ahead in favor of net neutrality. And a lot of other countries have these principles. So he said, you know, over time, this is something America will have to work out. But, you know, ultimately, America will, you know, I would think, have to catch up with the world and really have net neutrality principles.
Adam Cohen on the editorial board at The New York Times. Adam, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Let me get a call from Peter in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a small business owner. I have a previous career in high tech, where we developed custom solutions that use the internet to exchange blocks of data.
Okay.
And as a small business owner, a good portion of my revenues is my online presence, my online store.
Right.
There's a part that I see that requires open access to the internet for the entrepreneurial spirit in order to capitalize on what really drives our economy.
So are you afraid of being squeezed out if this becomes practice to charge for top delivery?
I am, and there's another aspect of this that concerns me. When I look at how much I pay to push my data through here in the U.S. compared to some business colleagues in Europe and especially colleagues in India and in South Korea, we pay a lot higher price for a lot slower throughput. I think that limits our academic capability. I think that limits our entrepreneurial spirit.
So there's the entrepreneur speaking up. Peter, our time is short before the break, but let me put it to Scott Cleland. Scott, would this disadvantage the little guy, the entrepreneur, who might be the breakthrough service provider on the web?
Of course not. I thank you for letting me get back into this debate. I mean, there is so much fear-mongering, so many slanderous accusations of accusing people of potentially doing things that there is no logical economic reason for companies to do this in a competitive world. You know, It's Arnett is saying that, you know, people aren't going to be able to, you know, moms aren't going to be able to take care of their children, and, you know, businesses aren't going to be able to get on the web. Those are the preposterous types of fear mongering, which there is absolutely no evidence of it.
Rob's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Rob, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What do you think, Rob?
I'm just sort of seeing another manifestation of where we're starting to confuse technology with freedom. And I guess what I mean by that is when we're seeing service as the ultimate sort of truth in the internet rather than variety. You know, basically when you're searching the web, if you're searching for esoteric or obscure information, regardless of its political content, you know, you're navigating an environment. And yes, service allows you to go through that quicker, but it also allows you to pass certain things by, I think. And I think in this situation, the market is sort of trying to interpret itself as the natural law for the internet rather than a situation where we've had, you know, a balance for a while of a real true freedom of information and a easily accessed, small universe of different opinions. And I just think, you know, a situation where you have large companies and their opinions, regardless of how free they make them seem, dictating everything, you're starting to reduce your scope.
Rob, we've got it, and it has been a unique animal from its birth here. may be becoming more like the rest of reality as we know it now. I want to invite into our conversation from Washington, Alan Davidson. He's a lobbyist and Washington Policy Counsel for Google. Mr. Davidson, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Google has come out in opposition to this hierarchy on the web, as I understand it, and in favor of something like net neutrality. Why?
Well, we believe that users are the ones who should control what they see and do online and what services they use. The fear is that the House of Representatives is going to vote next week on whether or not to give broadband carriers the ability to create this two-tier internet where they control the services and content that users will have best access to. And we think that kind of two-tier internet would be terrible for democratic speech online. It'd be terrible for small businesses, and we're part of a very large coalition of consumer groups and businesses who think that net neutrality is extremely important for the future of the Internet.
Scott Cleland says that it's fear-mongering to say that it's going to cut people off from things they want. For that matter, Google's a big company. Why don't you just endorse it and buy priority delivery yourself?
Well, that is a great point. It's exactly why this is really not about Google. Google and the other big Internet companies, we're the ones who will have the ability to cut those deals and make sure that our content gets preferential treatment online. But we think that would be terrible for the Internet. As our founder said, they would who started this company in a dorm room at Stanford, they would never have been able to create a Google if they had had to go out and cut deals with every large carrier in the country in order to be seen. And so I think this is really not about Google, and it's not, this is not the sky is falling. This is not a fiction. The broadband carriers, their CEOs have said in the papers they intend to do this. They've told us privately they've intended to do this. They tell Wall Street that they expect to make a lot of money doing this. And I think what more do we need to see before we know that there's a real problem?
Scott Cleland, Google's against you on this one. So is Microsoft, I guess. Are they fear-mongering? Why?
Well, let's look at the real moneyed interests behind the net neutrality and how did it pop up like it did. You know, Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, and eBay, who all have 80 to 90% gross margins, feel threatened by having the internet evolve and having it maybe not have the special deals they have right now. This is corporate welfare we're talking about. Net neutrality is basically locking in some past advantages, not letting the market evolve, not letting competition occur. What is really going on here is Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, eBay do not want competition from communications. They like the idea. Remember, all of these companies, Microsoft and eBay and Google and Yahoo, are all getting into the communications business and competing with communications companies. But, oh, no, it wouldn't be fair if communications companies could compete with them. And so there is a double standard going on here that is it's not sustainable.
Alan Davidson, you're just defending your own free lunch.
Well, I would ask the Consumers Union, which publishes Consumer Reports, Consumer Federation of America, the Christian Coalition, the National Religious Broadcasters, people who haven't taken a cent from any internet company, but who care deeply about this, whether this is a special interest issue. I think you'll hear a lot of consumers now, hundreds of thousands of consumers now signing an online petition saying this is a very real consumer issue. And I think it's exactly the opposite. What we're really seeing is the large telecommunications carriers who have armies of lobbyists here in Washington trying to change the internet into the cable network.
Let me take a call from Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think that there's a couple of things missing here. The telecom, specifically Verizon, who has spent millions lobbying for these two bills, 5252 in the House and 2686 in the Senate,
yep,
is that they want to slow down the competition.
That is, just as Scott Cleland says, they don't want Google and Microsoft to be on their heels with their own communication services?
Exactly. And they want to say, if you buy our stuff, you're going to get it much faster than buying our competition stuff. The other two things that are very important in these bills is they want a red line. So they do not want to have to give communities that either are low-income or in rural-based areas access to the Internet. They basically want to say, we're exempt from providing access to these folks. And the other thing that it's going to do is it's going to eliminate franchising fees for public access, educational access, and governmental access, because they're going to make it all decided on a federal level. So townships like Cambridge and Somerville and Lowell and all these others are not going to get the funding that they've typically got from these cable companies using the right of way.
If that legislation goes through. But Steve, let me ask you, is it fair for Google and others who might compete with the telecoms, is it fair for them to kind of freeload on the open net, Scott Cleland might say here, in that competition?
I think it is, because the net is open. And it's not that they're freeloading. I mean, they just decided to get into a different business than Verizon or AT&T or Comcast. And you know the reason why these guys go out into the DSL or the broadband business,
yep,
is because they want the control. And it isn't fair. And it's not, I mean, to create a high-speed lane for people that can afford it and a dirt road for everyone else, it's just going the same way our country is going, where the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting more devastated, and the middle class is being eliminated.
Steve, we've got it. Lawrence Lessig, Scott Cleland says it's corporate welfare for Alan Davidson's Google and Microsoft and eBay to ride along in the net-neutral universe.
Yeah, it's corporate welfare, and all these net neutrality people are a bunch of socialists. I mean, it's the same kind of rhetoric that comes out of Washington all the time, and it's so misleading about this debate. Of course, there is a democratic versus corporate spin to this debate, but I think the critical thing to recognize is this is also a debate about where competition in the future will be. So Yahoo's and Google's and Microsoft's are banding together to say, we want to keep the same kind of internet, which means that the next Yahoo and the next Google and the next Microsoft has an equal opportunity to destroy the existing incumbents. And what they're fighting is a network where the network owners use their power to protect themselves against exactly this kind of competition. Now, you just look at the network and you tell me which future you would rather see, the one that's produced by the kind of open competition that has given us Google, that has given us Yahoo and Microsoft, or the future that would be controlled by companies like Verizon or AT&T in its sixth new regenerated form. I mean, the point is, this is about future competition and applications and competition and in content. And by keeping the network neutral and open, you maximize competition. That's about wealth and growth as much as it's about making sure democratic access is available to all.
Jerry's calling from Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi. I had a question that I hope would illuminate it a little bit for me. You described that, you know, there'll be sort of a fast lane for people who pay more and then a dirt road for those who don't. And I'm wondering if over the medium term, say 3 to 5 to 7 years, will the dirt roads also get paved because of the advances of the sort of the paved road people?
So might it end up better for everybody ultimately?
Yeah, will it ultimately end up better for everybody?
Let's pick that up.
Can I just make one point about that? That's the critical competition point. If in fact they're paying, you have to pay for premium service, it creates a weird incentive, a perverse incentive for you to make sure that the premium service is actually premium. So unlike saying to consumers that if you pay more, you get faster service, which does create the incentive to build a faster internet for everybody, saying that if you want to be able to have premium service versus dirt road service, you've got to pay for it, creates the perverse incentive for people to continue to keep the unpaved road unpaved.
Scott Cleland, how about it? It's going to be always a two-tier system, you know, if henceforth, if this is the way we go.
Well, people look at it as, you know, trying to say this isn't a perfect world. Competition isn't perfect, and they're finding places that there may be imperfections, but it's vastly superior to having government bureaucrats decide all of these things for us. Remember, the only thing that's constant in life is change. And really what this is the net neutrality people are fighting change. The way the internet grew up, the tech sector and the internet grew up, is because Moore's Law, which is basically the faster and faster chips, enabled competition in technology and competition in the internet. Moore's Law is now allowing a renaissance of competition to occur in communications.
But Lawrence Lessig says it's just the other way around.
Saying, no, let's not allow competition to come to communications. We want to go back to a monopoly regulated, because then tech and internet can operate the way it always did. And what we need is we need to allow the internet and the marketplace to evolve with technology. Keep the market competitive.
I hear that. And yet, you know, the names that come to mind when you say monopoly is something more like AT&T than what we think of as the web. Alan Davidson, I know we have to let you go. Which way do you think this is going to go?
Well, we're very hopeful that when consumers and small businesses wake up and realize that the broadband carriers are trying to change the internet into a world where they have to pay to play, that they will be very upset about it. And I would just urge everybody who cares about this to get involved in the debate. And this is a real live fire exercise that's being voted on in Congress, and we're hopeful that the the idea of net neutrality will continue. This is a non-discrimination principle that has existed for a century in our telecommunications policy, and it should continue for the Internet as it has been.
Alan Davidson at Google, thanks very much for joining us today from Washington. Cynthia is calling from Washington. Hi, Cynthia, you're on the air.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm calling from Washington because I am co-founder of an organization called Washington Bureau for ISP Advocacy, because we're very concerned about this issue and would love to have the opportunity to weigh in.
Make it quick.
Well, one of the things we do is we keep hearing the argument from the Bell side that they're in favor of competition, but we see direct behavior that tells us contrary to that. As we're learning here, examples of this would be they're laying in new fiber optic networks, fiber to the home, and what happens is they're actually cutting the copper lines so that consumers now are locked consumers. They're not able to leave once they're owned, and it's a real concern to us.
So are you for the net neutrality legislation then? I guess
you
are.
I am in the sense that it's a shame we have to go this way, but our concern is that you're going to set up walled gardens if we don't have some kind of regulatory framework that ensures that every consumer can get online and have access to everything they want.
Cynthia, we've got it, and we thank you for your call. I want to get one more voice in here. Michael Greb is with us. He's contributing editor for Wired News of Wired Magazine. Michael Greb, thanks. You've been listening to this. What do you hear in this debate?
Oh, I'll tell you. How you doing, Tom?
Good.
I've just been sitting here. You've got a lot of smart people on the phone, but I think one thing that should be clear to your listeners by this point is that really this has been a battle of extremes. I mean, you know, I just did a big, long story on this. I probably talked to about a dozen people, some of the same people that have been on this call, from both sides. I talked to probably equal numbers on both sides, and not a single person ever really said to me, you know, we need to compromise on this. We need to sit down and work out an agreement.
Is there a compromise here? Is there one possible?
Well, they're going to have to. I mean, I think they all know that eventually they're going to have to compromise. I mean, with so many bills in Congress right now, you've got at least six different bills. They're all over the map. Some are very strict net neutrality bills. Others are very laissez-faire. And at some point, these guys are going to have to come together and figure out a solution. What I think is probably going to happen is, you know, I think both sides here have really good points. I mean, on one hand, you have net neutrality advocates who really believe that these corporations are going to abuse their power if they're given the chance. They're going to squash individual voices in smaller companies. There's some historical evidence that some of that may occur. I don't think necessarily as much as they're saying. And then you've got the other side that says, look, you're going to sap investment. You're going to chill investment if you limit our abilities to make a profit, basically. And there's some merit to that argument as well. But it's such an extreme, they're both on such extreme sides, they just refuse to come together on this until the last possible moment when they're forced to. And I think what eventually is going to happen is that, yes, we're going to have some type of net neutrality. It may not be as strict as the net neutrality advocates would like. It may put very basic limits upon the broadband pipe owners, and it may not go as far as they'd like, but I think it is going to allow them to sort of test some of these new business models and see what works. I'm just not sure that consumers are really going to go for this walled garden thing. I mean, the jury's still out on that, and that problem may solve itself, because if there's no huge market demand for that sort of model, and it's been tried in the past and it has not really worked that well, then this is going to just kind of solve itself, and the free market will work.
Might not fly in that direction. Lawrence Lessig, we're almost out of time here. Fork in the road or a compromise coming? How do you see it?
Yeah, I hope there's no compromise. But again, this is not just about whether investment happens on one side. It's about whether investment happens on both sides. So the next Google that comes along and tries to get venture capital money right now is facing this fear that because of this lack of access because of the network's behavior, they won't be able to get venture capital to launch their new investment. So the point is, this is about keeping investment and opportunity open at content and applications, which is critical to the growth of the Internet. Now, compromising that, sure, we could compromise that, but why do we have to just make it so a couple companies get a higher opportunity to exploit this Internet, which they, let's not forget, didn't invent and didn't build, but instead reluctantly allowed to come across their wires? That's the real choice, whether we're going to have this potential for competition that continues to produce the next generation Googles, or protect the last generation's AT&Ts.
Well, it's a battle royal, and we're trying to stay in the fast lane, trying to stay fast enough to keep up. Lawrence Lessig at Stanford Law School, founder of the Center for Internet and Society, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Michael Greb at Wired News. Michael, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
And Scott Cleland, chairman of netcompetition.org. Mr. Cleland, thanks for being here.
Thank you, sir.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.